You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This episode is brought to you in partnership with London-based Crew Cafe Coffee. To know me is to know that I love coffee. There's something so special about that first coffee of the day. It's not even a routine for me anymore. It's more of a ritual. But we all know that not all coffees are equal, and life is way too short for bad coffee. I'm sure lots of you listening will be familiar with Crew Cafe Coffee, but if you haven't yet discovered it, let me tell you, this is game-changing coffee. From sweet and floral Arabicas grown in Central America to bold and deep Robustas drenched by India's monsoon rains, their coffees are carefully chosen to unlock a whole world of flavor. Their coffee is so good, I've actually stopped drinking coffee with milk, which I never thought I would. And of course, you can still enjoy a milky coffee, but I just find the flavor of the coffee is so good, I don't need to add milk to mine anymore. And much like with wine, and believe me, I am not a wine expert, but you can really taste the different notes from light and bright fruits, dark chocolate, and rich earthy ones. It's a whole new world, I'm telling you. They also happen to be 100% organic, B Corp, and fair trade. They pay an additional premium to the farmers, which then gets reinvested back into the local community to pay for water supplies, schools, and health centres. So this is a company that's creating not only a better cup of coffee for you, but also the farming communities and the planet. What's not to love? This is coffee for connoisseurs. You can find them online at crewcafe.com, where you can currently get 50% off their discovery box. That's crewcafe.com. They're also available at Waitrose. Thank you very much to Crew Cafe. Hi, I'm Margie Nomura, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the podcast where every week I ask my guests to choose their 7 Desert Island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. The question is, what would you choose as your last meal? Hi, I hope you're all very well. We have a lovely episode for you today with the brilliant John Watts. Lots of you, I'm sure, will be familiar with John from his amazingly successful social media or his regular TV appearances, as his career really goes from strength to strength. But it's the story of how John got to where he is today that I really wanted to share. Food and cooking mean so many different things to different people. You could grow up in a family obsessed with food and all that comes with it, or you might not, and still find your way to cooking later in life. And cooking can provide opportunity, and it's a passion that you can find at any stage of life. You could grow up in a world of privilege and opportunity and still never quite make anything of yourself. Or you can feel lost as a teenager and get caught up with the wrong crowd. And yet you can turn your life around, and it's never too late for that. And John has done exactly that, which I think is very inspiring. His first book has just come out, which looks brilliant. His recipes are easy and delicious. And actually, the day after we recorded this episode, I was sitting on the bus, and the women in front of me were planning what they were going to cook that week. And they were raving about John and his recipes, which I loved overhearing. I do hope you enjoyed today's episode. Let us know what you think. And without further ado, here is John's Desert Island Dishes. My guest today is John Watts. You may well know John from his friendly, down-to-earth cooking videos online, where he has amassed a huge following of avid fans. But what you may not know is that John is where he is today through a lot of hard work and determination to completely turn his life around. He left school at the age of 16 with no idea what he wanted to do. He found himself hanging out with the wrong crowd and was constantly getting into trouble. In 2008, he was sentenced to a Young Offenders Institute, and he said he had two choices: to spend 23 hours a day in a cell or to sign up for everything he could. He signed up for the Duke of Edinburgh's award, and in that moment, he says he changed the entire course of his life. John became the first person ever to earn a gold Duke of Edinburgh award whilst in prison, receiving the award from Prince Philip himself. He then went on to work for Jamie Oliver, where his passion for food was really ignited. And now, 16 years on, he runs a successful food business working as a chef and has just released his first cookbook. Welcome, John.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always interesting listening to someone introduce me because it just feels like you're talking about someone else. I'm like, cool, who is this guy? I'm like, wow, that's me.
I was going to ask you that. Like, could you ever have imagined 16 years ago what your life would look like now?
I really love sort of sitting down with people, chatting about it with a glass of wine and sort of taking myself back. Because I don't do it very often. I'm very sort of forward thinking. And when I do think about it, I'm like, just wow. Like, I mean, 16 years. So I think every 5-year period has always been a huge sort of monumental period for me. And to just imagine I was even halfway to where I am now would have been absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it's amazing to think, isn't it? And there are so many things that I want to talk to you about. But I'm thinking that with the gold Duke of Edinburgh under your belt, being cast off to a desert island is going to be a breeze.
Yeah, that definitely ignited another passion in me as well. So, food is number one, but mountains and, you know, being adventurous and getting outdoors is number two. So I would jump at the getting onto a desert island. I think I'd enjoy it for a couple of weeks. I'm quite introverted as well.
Okay. But a couple of weeks might be the cutoff.
Yeah. I mean, there's going to become a point, isn't there?
Let's dive straight into the first desert island dish. What's the dish that most reminds you of your childhood?
Do you know what? This is a really difficult question for me to answer. And I do not have that stereotypical, you know, answer that everybody has. Everyone in food will have like a memory of their grandma's cooking, their mum or their dad, or somewhere they used to go, something that reminds them of their childhood. For me, food was really not a big part. You know, I've been thinking about it a lot over this last week, and honestly, it's Angel Delight. I know a lot of people don't even know what Angel Delight is, but you know, for anyone that doesn't know, it's that, how do you describe it, you know, processed powder that you mix with milk and pop it in the fridge and it sets into like a jelly type thing,
like a mousse. Yeah. But it's magic. It has to be butterscotch though, doesn't it?
100%. Yeah, I don't mind the chocolate one, but yeah, it's all about the butterscotch one. I will say, you know, for me, when I do think about food when I was younger, we did always have that sort of family thing. We would all be at the dinner table at 6 o'clock having dinner. But the actual food was just not a part of it. Like my dad, even today, he's getting a bit better now, but he's very much a food is fuel kind of person. So I didn't grow up around where people are foodies and they really enjoy and take care over what they're cooking and eating.
But that's interesting, isn't it? That even though food wasn't central to it, you did still all sit down as a family and it was like a moment of being together.
Yeah, and something that I took for granted. I think when I think back, you know, that was such a lovely time and something that I think is quite important in like a family unit. But, you know, at the time when you're young, it's you want to be out with your friends. Yeah. You don't want to be called in and playing your games. You know, it's the worst thing to have to go down for dinner.
Yeah, at the time it's so annoying. And then when you look back, it's like, oh, those were the best times. You said that you didn't really enjoy school and you dropped out at 16 as soon as you realized that it wasn't compulsory. At the time, you've described feeling very lost and confused about what you were going to do. And you say that you had no drive or ambition and you were at war with yourself, but also the world around you. Can you tell us a little bit more about that time?
Wow. Are those my words? I think they are. I don't know where you've got those from, but yeah. I recognize them. Yeah, I think it was a funny time because, I mean, those words sort of sum it up perfectly. Just lost, frustrated. I felt like I was worthy of being someone and doing good things and finding a passion. But it just, I think where I grew up, there wasn't really a lot of opportunities. There wasn't much guidance from the school as well. I remember feeling quite let down. I think misunderstood is a good way to put it. You know, I'd miss out on a lot of opportunities through getting a lot of detentions. And I just think no one gave me any sort of time. So I just felt like essentially, you know, not many people cared about me. And that just led to me having those sorts of feelings. And I think when you're younger, you just don't know where to go, where to turn. And that was very much what it was. So yeah, I left school and started working, but it was the same sort of thing. I was just, you know, at that age with no qualifications, I was just going into dead end jobs, places where, you know, making minimum wage for hard labor and nothing exciting. And when I was faced with older groups of people and people that were involved in, you know, the not very nice things, which essentially you could call sort of gang related things, that just appealed to me because it was a place where I felt understood. It was a place where I felt like I belonged somewhere for the first time. And yeah, that sort of escalated.
It's so difficult, isn't it? Because school is such an unrealistic representation of life. And yet it only has this very rigid way of determining whether you are a somebody and whether you're going to succeed. And it's so wrong, isn't it? Because who cares about the stuff that you learn there? But it can be really uninspiring. And I wondered when I was reading your story, when you look back now, what could have happened differently that would have meant that the turn of events would have been different?
I think it comes down to just guidance. I really, really dislike blaming anyone or anything for how I ended up or where I ended up. I mean, I think a huge part of why I am where I am now is because I've taken responsibility myself. But, you know, at that age, you are a child. And I think some of the responsibility does come onto other people and other things. And I just think a little bit of guidance. I mean, one thing I noticed at school was I would miss out on, you know, when you're picking your classes and things, and I would miss out on all the ones that I had chosen to do because I think my last name was ended in a W. So if I think back to nobody wanted to do graphics, everyone wanted to do cooking or the woodwork when it came to the technical ones. And I just remember being at school and looking around the class and everybody's last name was a W or at the end of the alphabet. And I think it was a matter of just like, okay, we've given everyone what they wanted. Now we've got these people left, we'll chuck them in that class. And that happened with a few different classes. So I was away from the people that I, you know, liked being with, doing the classes that I wasn't really very interested in. So I think that was just the first part of being essentially forgotten, I would say.
God, so if you've got a name ending in W, you should double barrel it with a A, it's ASAP. You're right. It's never one person's responsibility, but it's when like a collection of things happen. I think it's when it leads to someone feeling the way that it made you feel. That's ultimately the worst thing that can happen for a young person, because when you're 16, you feel very grown up, but now that we're older, 16 is so young, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to a friend who's a psychologist recently, and she was saying about how the brain isn't fully formed until your sort of late 20s, especially the sort of frontal lobe. So in young people, they might feel mature, but I think the frontal lobe deals with the sort of decision-making and things. So, you know, if you are made to feel a certain way and, you know, your brain's still going through that sort of maturing process, then you know, it's a very difficult place to be. And the decisions you make are not the ones that you'd make when you're an adult thinking straight.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Let's pause there and talk about the second desert island dish. What was the first dish you learnt to cook?
Right. So, I mean, I was in the prison doing the MVQ in professional cookery. So I was learning to cook all the basics, a bechamel sauce, apple crumbles and pies and all sorts of, you know, your classic dishes. But the first dish that I mastered is focaccia. And that was when I ended up cooking in a restaurant. Ooh. So, I mean, my real passion for food came when I started in the restaurant. And I was around passionate chefs and I was seeing ingredients I'd never seen before. And there was just an adrenaline. And I was put on focaccia duty. So I was making focaccia every single morning. And
wow.
Do you know who used to come in quite often back in those days? Was Gennaro Cantaldo. the Italian stallion.
Thought you were going to say that.
And, you know, for anyone that's seen him, he's usually on Saturday Kitchens and he's very eccentric. And, oh, he's great on TV, isn't he? I think he's really entertaining. When you're in the kitchen with him, he's great as well. But, oh, my God, the pressure of making this bread around him, and every time he'd come in, and it was just incredible, really, especially looking back, being taught something like that by him. And he used to tell me, you know, treat the dough like a baby and be very delicate with it. And I used to just be really proud of every good batch of focaccia that I made. So yeah, I think that's what I would call, you know, the first real dish that I mastered.
What, how many times do you think you have to make something like focaccia to really master it?
That's a tough question. I think, yeah, a good few hundred times. So, you know, being very new to it back then, it took that time to sort of develop that naturalness, maybe.
And Jamie Oliver, I mean, he was such a huge part of culture when we were growing up. Was he someone that you were very aware of as a teenager before you went to work with him?
I mean, before going into prison, I definitely knew who he was. I mean, he was famous, wasn't he, for ruining the school dinners a bit before that. No one was ever very keen on him.
What, because he got rid of turkey Twizzlers?
Yeah, I think people sort of in my age bracket now are still angry about turkey Twizzlers. It's funny. I was never a big fan of the turkey Twizzlers anyway. But yeah, I just think, I mean, he was, you know, what the biggest name in the industry. So he was definitely aware. And I can't remember when I became aware about 15, but I think it was during my time in prison. And it was mentioned to me a few times when I was cooking, and it was always the goal to try and get in there. So it was difficult to get into 15 because I was already in custody, but they offered me to go into the chain of restaurants, which is where, you know, a certain select few people took me under their wing and essentially nurtured me and gave me an opportunity, showing me, nurturing me. And I'm so thankful to them for that now. It essentially taught me work ethic. Can you teach work ethic? I think you can. Mm. Little things as well. Like, I was going out on day release from the prison. So I was on a resettlement unit, which was kind of like an open prison. Not inside, but I was able to go out in that sense. So they would release me at 6:30 in the morning, and I would go to the restaurant, work for 10 hours, go back. And Ian, the head chef there, he used to get me in an hour earlier than everybody else. He'd get me to iron my chef whites and stuff. So I was in the kitchen an hour before everyone, presentable, and then I would be able to get ahead of people. I think it just taught me about, you know, being prepared, being there, and looking after yourself, you know. And I just think it sort of taught me that sort of organisation and that work ethic, which I think has stuck with me today and is a big part of how I've been able to sort of grow into the person that I am today.
When I was reading about you, you talk about your time as a 16-year-old, and you say that you did always have in the back of your mind this feeling that one day you would be a success. But I wondered, at that point, what did success look like?
Cool. At 16, I'm not sure quite what success looked like, because I just had no idea. And when I sort of mentioned that, I think what I meant was I just felt like I was worthy of something, like I had a lot to give. It's really difficult to explain. It was that feeling that led to the frustration, because I didn't know how to get into anything that I wanted to do. I didn't understand about university or education. I didn't actually know that that was possible for me. It's only as I've got older that I realised that actually a university education is accessible for a lot of people. But to me, it was something that I thought was reserved for rich people, or, you know, really clever people.
Let's pause there and talk about the third desert island dish. What's the best dish you've ever eaten?
So the best dish I've ever eaten, and this is going back to that restaurant setting again, and, you know, not being a foodie as a child, then being in a Young Offenders where the food is, there's not a lot of budget there. It's awful.
Okay.
So being in that restaurant setting, I remember getting my first bowl of staff food, which was a spaghetti bolognese with crunchy pangrattata. So have you heard of pangrattata, which is, yeah, the herby breadcrumbs with garlic. Mm. And they call it poor man's parmesan in Italy.
Oh, really? Is that what they say?
Yeah. Yeah. So you know, for the people that couldn't afford Parmesan, they would use these crunchy breadcrumbs, which just adds so much to the dish. And I just remember sitting down. I didn't eat a lot, actually, when I was there, because for anyone that's worked in a restaurant, they'll know it's hard labour and you don't really drink or eat for most of the day. You're on your feet and you're essentially trying to be a superhuman. And I remember at the end of a really, really long day, sitting down and somebody gave me the bolognese. And I was like, wow, this is the best thing I've ever eaten. And it's all to do with that sort of circumstance, isn't it? Because I haven't had good food. If I was going to list the best food I've ever eaten, I think would be Le Manoir in Oxfordshire, 2 Michelin star, Raymond Blanc's restaurant. You know, if I was going for the best food. But when it comes down to like the atmosphere and the experience, you know, the best dish was sitting down and eating that bolognese at the end of a hard few days. It wasn't on the first day, it was a few days. So, you know, I would have to go for that.
Something about your story when I was reading about it, I don't want to overplay this, but I do think it's very admirable, because when you arrived in prison, you obviously were at a crossroads. I was thinking it would have been very easy just to kind of give in to a feeling of helplessness almost and accept your situation. And that's exactly the opposite of what you went about doing by signing up for all the things you did and all these courses that you did. Was there ever a doubt in your mind that that was how you were going to approach it?
No, I mean, I was very lucky for this reason. So the offence that happened that put me in prison happened in July of 2007. And I wasn't actually put into custody until January 2008. And during that time, a lot happened. My life and the life of people around me changed drastically in not a pleasant way. And I very much at that point realised, okay, I'm doing the wrong thing. I'm going down the wrong path and something needs to change. So I was able to accept that I was going to be in that position. I was going to be in custody, and certainly for a couple of years at least. So I approached it with that mindset. Whereas for a lot of people, if you know, something happens and you're arrested and you're put into custody the next morning, you're straight away just thrown in. You know, it's like a tornado of emotions and things. I was able to walk into the dock in court with a bag of clothes and things ready to go. And I think that helped me massively. It's something that a lot of people can't do. And it was just down to the circumstances surrounding what was going on with me at the time. So yeah, I mean, going in there with that mindset already, I just was super driven to like make something of myself. I felt like such a failure. I was a failure. I felt like such a failure. I was so ashamed. You know, I was just embarrassed for my family to have to be associated with me. I felt like I had to do something to make amends for it.
Taking the opportunity to do the Duke of Edinburgh was a moment that you've said ultimately changed the entire course of the rest of your life. And everybody has these moments when they look back at their life, and you may not be aware of them as they're happening, but you see when you look back these certain decisions that led you in a particular direction, whether it's good or bad. Did it feel momentous in that moment when you decided to sign up? Did you feel like this was really going to be something that would change things for you?
Yeah, I think definitely. I never, ever expected to go as far as I did with the Duke of Edinburgh Award. And I remember it was funded by Reading Football Club, and some of their people came in and told us about it and what we can expect. And there was about 100 young inmates in that room, and they only had space for 15 people. And they were talking about how it could affect you and, you know, their dream. I remember one of them saying, "My dream is to see some of you at the Palace getting your gold award." And I just remember, I am quite big on the law of attraction. And I just remember thinking about it at the time and picturing that being me, even though at that time I did not think it was going to be possible. I was one of the 15 picked to do it. Again, down to circumstances, it's the length of your sentence, the other courses that you're doing in there, how well you've been behaved in there. It just came down to so many different factors. And I was lucky enough to be one of those 15 to start working towards it. I think the moment I started, I felt like I'd already achieved something. And it was already something to phone home about and say, I'm taking part in the Duke of Edinburgh's Award and I'm working towards my bronze. So it's just that first step towards what I was talking about, you know, making amends and being able to, you know, make my family proud of me rather than ashamed of me.
And what does the gold involved, because it's pretty mega, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, bronze, silver and gold, they're split up into sections. So you've got four sections in the bronze, silver and gold. You've got an extra section for the gold.
Okay.
For the four sections. Let's see if I can remember on the spot. So you have the skill section, obviously, which I went for cooking. You've got the volunteering. So I was a listener, which was basically prisoners trained by the Samaritans to be Samaritans. So you're there to take a call from someone, and in prison it is face-to-face. And you listen to someone who is going through, it could be anything from just missing a family member to feeling suicidal, and sometimes it would be really, really dark stuff. And I think being involved in that in particular helped to grow me as a person, because I was, first of all, given responsibility to be in that situation, and you're living with these people and you have to keep these things confidential. And I think having that responsibility and being trusted was a big deal. But then also just learning empathy and realizing that everybody, no matter who they are, where they come from, goes through difficult emotions and hard times. And just to be able to help people as well. So that was really sort of beneficial to my personal growth. There was the expedition. So typically you'd be stomping up hills in the mud and camping out. For the silver and gold, I was able to get out on the temporary license and do it. I did the silver sections but left the expedition until later on, when I was able to go out and then sort of did them close together. So we did have to be a bit tactile in that sense. But for the bronze, we basically did this thing called the Jailer's Challenge. So we had to create this team building challenge that went all around the sort of grounds of the prison, and you're just sort of learning how to work with people. You're learning communication skills, all the simple skills that I think someone like me lacked. And it just boosts your self-confidence, your self-esteem, which are all the things that support yourself going forward. So it's all been really beneficial.
I know you said you don't ever like to assign blame, but it's all of those things are things that school should have been giving you, aren't they?
I know, you are right. It's just, yeah, I like to take responsibility and put it all on myself, but...
When you were at school, if you'd been offered the chance to do the Duke of Edinburgh, would it have appealed to you in different circumstances?
Actually, no, because it has, or certainly had, a certain reputation, and it wouldn't have been the cool thing to do. Yeah. So.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, in the circles I was in, it just, you know, it wouldn't have been the thing to do. However, I think when you're in somewhere like being in custody, all those things, they go out the window. It's all about bettering yourself, taking the opportunity. And it was the, you know, one of, if not the best thing I ever did.
We've had many terrible segues on this podcast, John, but I think this might be my worst. We're going to talk about the fourth Desert Island dish now. John, what is your favourite sandwich?
Another tough one. I've gone for roast beef, caramelised onion and a bit of rocket. In ciabatta.
That's a great sandwich.
Yeah, I just think, you know, compare it with mustard or horseradish or something like that. Have you ever heard of the six things that a sandwich is supposed to be?
Yes.
It's three things, but the opposite. So I believe it's hot, cold, sweet, sour, crunchy, soft.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. You nailed it. But it's true when you think, and not just sandwiches, I guess that's kind of true of dishes as well. Like if you're creating a dish or thinking about why something works, it's because there's always this contrast, and that's what makes something so satisfying to eat. That is a great sandwich, because that's the kind of good sandwich that you can make just as it is. But then it's also, you can form it as leftovers, can't you? And then that makes it even better.
Mm, absolutely.
What are your thoughts on the Boxing Day sandwich?
As in like turkey and stuffing?
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah. But are you of the opinion that it's better than the Christmas lunch itself?
Or... I mean, the Christmas lunch just gets overhyped, isn't it? When something gets hyped up so much, it never lives up to the expectations, which is why I think most people's favourite ever meal is something that's not really extreme.
People's favourite meals are always just so simple, and is what everyone always just has to remember when you're having friends over. People, it's about the occasion. You've described the time that you met Prince Philip at a reception for young people receiving their Duke of Edinburgh awards. That must have been very surreal.
Yeah, so I was lucky enough. I've met him three times. And the first time, I didn't really recognise the significance actually. And I was at this event for the Duke of Edinburgh's Award, and he sort of did the rounds. And he asked me what I did for the expedition. And I told him, oh, I was in prison. I did this and this. And he asked me if we were all attached by ball and chain, which was quite funny, you know, stomping around the mountains attached by ball and chain. And then I met him, it can't have been very long after, and this is all on camera because I was lucky enough that they were filming me as part of a documentary on him for the BBC. So I'm able to look back. Otherwise, I'd probably think it was a dream and it didn't happen. Mm. But I was getting my gold award and I was with two officers from the prison who had taken me through it, and my dad was allowed there. And I was still 2 weeks away from being officially released. And again, he spoke to me, and this wasn't the BBC saying, can you speak to him? They had no power like that. They very much just put the camera around and tried, like, hoped that he was going to talk to me. And that time he asked me about my service and what I did. So I told him I worked alongside the Samaritans. And I think that time, because the BBC were filming it, and the producer had sort of told me a lot of Prince Philip's background and the sort of historical part. And that's where I was like, oh, wow, this is quite a big deal that I'm sort of meeting this guy, especially coming from where I'd come from and what I'd just been through. But yeah, really, really incredible experience. And like I said, I'm so glad it's on film so that I can actually be like, because otherwise it'd be one of those things you're like, did that really happen?
Yeah, not to put too fine a point on it, but that obviously was very meaningful to you and amazing, but it must have also been quite meaningful to him. Like, you were the first person to ever receive their gold awards whilst being in prison. Mm. And ultimately that's what he set the award up for. That must have been an amazing moment for him as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think he used to play it down a lot, the whole scheme. I think he used to play it down.
Mm.
But yeah, I think it had the desired effect. I've often described the Duke of Edinburgh's Award as well like a sort of template for life. I mean, when I was in custody, you get all these offending behaviour problems ranging from anger management to enhanced thinking skills. And they're all the things that these people going through that should be going through. But it's all done in a very sort of, you know, classroom environment where people don't want to be there. Whereas something like the Duke of Edinburgh's Award, you want to do it, you're achieving something, and it's just helping you develop and grow, which is exactly what it was brought out to do, into a good member of society. So I hope he was proud. I mean, the third time that I met him was, I was at a big charity event and I wasn't supposed to talk, and they put a video of me up on the screen, but then a famous comedian sort of introduced me onto the stage. David Walliams it was, and he made a comment about me being too shy to talk. That wasn't the reason. I was told not necessarily to say anything. They were like, oh, just go up there. It was like 600 people in the audience. We're going to play the video. They can give a round of applause just so they see you. And he made a comment like that. And I was like, oh no, I'm going to say something now. Because he put it on me a little bit. And I just remember looking down, and I could see Prince Philip with a big grin on his face, and I think he was probably quite happy that I'd been like, no, I'll show you, I will say something.
God, John, that's made me feel like instantly hot and sweaty thinking about going up in front of 600 people, not having thought you'd say anything and then having to say something. That's amazing. Let's pause there and talk about the fifth desert island dish. What's the dish you eat the most often?
Does pasta count as a dish?
Yes, definitely. What's your go-to sauce? How do you have it?
The thing I love about pasta is it's so versatile, isn't it? You can have anything. But I have to say, I think a carbonara is my favourite, you know, go-to pasta, because it's so quick. And I think, you know, a lot of people were intimidated by the egg scrambling and things like that. But I think when you get the knack and you can make it, it's just so quick, easy, delicious. It's got a bit of everything.
When you went to work for Jamie Oliver, you've described that time as really the moment that ignited your passion for cooking. But I wondered, like, the whole restaurant environment. I know you were the first to get in every day, and you've talked about that a little bit. But did you instantly love the restaurant itself?
Honestly, I mean, when I was in custody and I was learning to cook, doing the MVQ, it was only something to give me an opportunity, to give me a job. That was all it was. From probably the first minute I walked in that restaurant, I was in love. It was just everything about it, the smell, the passion coming off of people. Like I said earlier, the adrenaline around the place, the ingredients, I always remember walking in the big walk-in fridge and just seeing stacks and stacks of fresh herbs that I didn't know existed. And I'd be like smelling each one. It's like, wow. Because I was used to any dried herbs before that. And I just remember always being like, you know, oregano and mixed herbs and thyme and rosemary when they're dried. They're all very similar. It's like, what is this? But when you've got the fresh herbs there, you're like, wow. And then I just think it's so incredible how something can grow from a seed and then you have this beautiful ingredient that you can use. And I was learning about the different ingredients and the quality. You know, a tomato off the shelf from a supermarket is not the same as a tomato that's come from the mountains or the hills of Italy. You know, it's completely different. And when you're using the right produce, you can just create incredible things. And I just, I fell in love. I think I described it once as, that was where the fire was lit inside of me and it's still raging.
I think some people go through life and they never find that thing. So it's amazing that you found it at the point that you did. And yeah, you were learning two things at once, because I think the ingredient thing is one thing, which is kind of mind-blowing. And then the actual process of cooking, which is also, I always say this, and I think it always sounds really cheesy, but it is kind of magical when you first start learning to cook and you just turn ingredients into a dish and it's watching that whole process happen. So yeah, it's incredible that that happened all at the same time. Your first cookbook is now out, which is very exciting. Was writing a cookbook something that you ever dreamt about?
I think from the moment I was sort of into cooking, I think when I really started enjoying it, it was always working under Jamie Oliver and obviously what he's done. And I don't know, he's probably the biggest cookbook writer ever in the world. So I think I sort of looked at that and thought, you know, that's the dream. That's the ultimate goal. It was one of those, I didn't know how it would come about, but I think I always knew that at one day I would have a cookbook, have a recipe book, and I would have loved to have done it sooner, but I don't know. I didn't really know how to go about it. And it was the pandemic pushing me into sharing recipes on social media, which has catapulted me into that world where it's become something that is now reality.
Oh, that's so interesting, because obviously you have this enormous following online now, but that was really spurred on by the pandemic.
Oh, absolutely. So I was cooking for quite a few celebrities and things before the pandemic, and I was catering. I had my own business and I was catering for all sorts of events. So I had a fairly good following. I think it's about 9,000. And when the pandemic hit, and everything I'd been working for disappeared, like the whole industry collapsed. And I was just cooking for one client in this most beautiful kitchen. I started to just film the recipes I was doing because I had so much time. And I posted it and I noticed it was, you know, being engaged with a lot and people enjoyed it. People were asking for more. So I just carried on. Believe it or not, the first recipe I filmed for social media was seared scallops with truffle and porcini, which cost about, just the ingredients, about £60 to feed two people.
Very relatable, John.
Yeah, and I just find it so funny how it's gone from that to now, you know, these really quick and easy dishes that anyone can make at home. So
I guess because with food media, there are like two sides to it, aren't there? There's like the aspirational side of, oh, that's something I would never cook. It's expensive. It's difficult. I don't know how I would do that, but I want to watch how it's done. Yeah. And the other side is like, show me something that I can easily make. And you've had both sides of the spectrum.
Yeah, that's definitely the side that I have adapted to become, is that easy to make recipes. And I think that's why my following has grown so much. And I just hit 500,000 today, 500,000 followers on Instagram, almost 500,000 on TikTok. And it's just from sharing these videos that I enjoy making. And that's the fun thing. I enjoy making them. I enjoy the engagement that comes with making them.
Imagine all of those people standing in a stadium.
I used to think about it like that.
Not to freak you out.
As it was growing, I used to think about it like, it fills Stamford Bridge now, which is 45,000. Oh, I've nearly got Wembley. Wow, I can fill Wembley. Now I can fill two Wembley. And now it's like, oh my goodness.
Life has changed so much over the last 16 years. What does the future hold in terms of what's left on the list of things for you to achieve? Would you like to open your own restaurant?
Yeah, I mean, leading up to 2020, at the beginning of 2020, that was the plan, to open somewhere. It was actually going to be a deli and a cookery school. And I had investment and the premises and the contract was in front of me. And then, you know, COVID happened and everything shut down. And in a way, I'm quite grateful because, I mean, it just wasn't the right time. I think for me, forget outside circumstances and what was going on in the world, but just wasn't really the right time. And I've sort of been put on this path now where I'm really quite happy and I feel quite fulfilled and there's a lot of potential. But in terms of a restaurant in the future, absolutely. My cousin's a big foodie. We grew up together, we're the same age, and neither of us were foodies growing up, but now he's a huge foodie as well. And he would quite like to open a restaurant with me. I think at some point we're going to make it happen.
That's amazing, because that's what everyone always says about business partners. If you have a sibling or a best friend or a relation, they always are going to make the best business partners. So that feels very exciting. We're on to the sixth desert island dish. What is your go-to dinner party dish?
This is the easiest question for me to answer. Beef Wellington.
Ooh.
A lot of people will shy away from it. People that like a challenge will jump at it. And it's a difficult dish to perfect.
What's your secret?
I've got a few different secrets. I mean, I would always sear the fillet and make the mushroom duxelles the night before. Okay. And even wrap it the night before as well. So wrap the beef with the mushroom and sort of parma ham or whatever you're using. Wrap it quite tightly and it almost sets in the fridge overnight. Then wrap it in the pastry. But then I'll also wrap the pastry quite tightly to secure it. Then in the fridge again, so that it's all set and secure, and then onto a hot tray, which is quite important.
Oh, okay.
There's a few steps as well. Sorry, I missed out things like the mushrooms, really making sure there's no liquid in them, because what you want is a crisp bottom, and I will get it every single time without fail nowadays. After making hundreds and hundreds of beef Wellingtons as a private chef, it was always the most popular dish. I think because it's not something that people can make easily, and it's not something you can eat out often either. Not many places have it. So people would choose it quite often. So I feel like I've perfected it. And now it is also something that if you do know how to make, you can get it ready beforehand. So having it in the fridge, brushing it with egg wash, and then it's ready. You know, it's in the oven and it's ready. So it's not like you're slaving away in the kitchen to get something ready while people are enjoying themselves. It's something you can prepare beforehand, and it's the ultimate showstopper.
Well, yeah, if I turned up to my friend's house and they served me beef Wellington, I would be very happy. I think it's scary because the fillet is such an expensive cut of meat. I think people are so scared of overcooking it. I remember one of the first private chefing jobs I ever did, they wanted fillet for 50 people, and I turned up and they only had an aga, and I don't know what the temperatures of an aga. Oh my God, John. It was so stressful.
Oh, I feel your pain. I always find it funny because people who have an aga, they're so excited to get you in their kitchen. They're like, come over, you can cook in the aga. And I'm like, oh no.
No.
I think they're great. They look incredible. And I love them. But
gorgeous. They look gorgeous. Yeah. But they're all different temperatures. Every aga is very, very different.
It's not practical.
Very stressful. No, you're definitely not for a beef Wellington. When you do a dinner party, do you often do a pudding?
Yeah, quite often. And the most popular one is the chocolate fondant, the melt in the middle, which again, fairly straightforward. You can get them made the day before and then into the oven 8 to 10 minutes and they're ready.
But do you think it shows like MasterChef that have scarred people? Because the fondant is actually quite an easy pudding.
Yeah.
But I think we've watched so many dry cake ones on MasterChef that maybe people are scared.
Yeah, that's just, it's all for theatrical effect, isn't it?
If in doubt, undercook.
Yeah, you can undercook them as well, and they're usually fine. The white chocolate ones are difficult. I've had those split on me a couple of times. But
yeah, I don't think I've ever had a white chocolate fondant.
Yeah, because of the low cocoa content, they're quite difficult, but you can make them work, but temperamental. I probably wouldn't do it often. I'd do it more for myself rather than in a high-pressured environment.
On Desert Island Dishes, we have a cookbook corner. So I'd love to know, what is your most treasured cookbook?
So Cooking with the MasterChef by Michel Roux Jr. And I've never actually cooked anything from it, but I met him at an event, one of the Duke of Edinburgh Award events, just before my release. And he just gave me like a few sort of words of wisdom, which to him won't have meant anything, but to me it meant a lot. And so the first cookbook I bought when I was released and I was in my own place and I was able to cook for myself was Cooking with the MasterChef. And then fairly recently I met him again, for the third time actually, but I was given that book as part of this campaign that I was working on, and I got it signed. So I think now that is my most treasured cookbook.
What were his words of advice?
Do you know what? I can't even remember.
But it felt really meaningful at the time.
At the time, I just remember feeling, you know, I'd seen him on MasterChef and, you know, to see him in real life. I don't think I'd ever seen a famous person before that day. So to see someone who I'd known from, you know, the world of media and to talk to me and essentially encourage me, it meant a lot to me.
I think it's so interesting because so often people's stories do have these interactions with people, and it doesn't have to be a celebrity, but it's amazing how you have these interactions. It might not have meant anything to the other person, but to you it means so much. And I think like it's just a lesson that we can all learn from, because you just never know what impact a tiny little moment is going to have on someone else's life, particularly young people. Okay, we're on to the final seventh desert island dish. John, what is the last dish you would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island?
I want a really decent steak, cooked well. Not well done, but cooked well. What cut would I go for? Probably a nice Wagyu ribeye with mac and cheese, maybe a truffle mac and cheese, push the boat out, triple cooked duck fat chips, creamed spinach, you know, carb overload, get ready for the incoming weeks of starvation. And then it's got to be some butterscotch angel delight.
Oh, it has to be. Have you tried making your own version of it, angel delight?
No, I haven't actually. That might be something I look into.
Let's do it as a collab. John, those are your desert island dishes. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So there we have it, another delicious day of Desert Island Dishes. Don't forget that you can rate, review and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. It really does make such a difference. It boosts the show in the charts and helps others to find it, which is great and means that I can keep bringing it to you each week. If you don't already, then come and follow me on Instagram at Desert Island Dishes. And you can also sign up for the brand new newsletter, Dinner Tonight, at desertislanddishes.co. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next week. Bye.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You have 5 new messages. Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.